Now he was having trouble selling stories in that genre and was reappraising himself, shifting gears. Science fiction was considered a literary ghetto by many anyway, and Frank Herbert felt it might be best to get away from it. He also had a couple of stories in mind for the men's magazine market, including Playboy and Rogue, magazines that were doing better than others financially and were paying their writers well. He even considered television script writing for a time, but Lurton discouraged him from that, telling him it was too tough to break into with his background. A Game of Authors, a title taken from a card game, was about an American writer in Mexico searching for a famous lost author. This was a familiar plot device in the works of Frank Herbert, a character investigating something in the manner of a reporter. The story featured international intrigue, a femme fatale, and a lake filled with piranhas. Unfortunately, it was melodramatic, with poor use of suspense and thin characterizations. The story met the same fate as Dad's recent science fiction tales. In part, this had to do with a length problem. It was too long for the extremely limited magazine markets, and around 12,500 words too short for a novel. Still, Lurton made every effort to sell it without changes. The best hope seemed to be serialization in a magazine. Around this time, Dad wrote another mainstream story, Paul's Friend. Set on an island in the South Pacific shortly after World War II, it was told in the first person, with an unnamed character listening to a story about a mysterious black man whose bravery in a hurricane was legendary. Paul's Friend, while a saleable length at 4,000 words, did not find a publisher. And he wrote a real gem, a wild 10,000-word story told in the first person, bearing the improbable title Wilfred. It described a would-be singer of inferior voice and ludicrous appearance who happened to hit the right combination of acoustics in a recording session, producing beautiful music. Sadly, Wilfred, like Dan's other non-science fiction attempts, did not sell. In another genre, science fiction book and magazine publishers continued to reject Storyship, which was only a couple of thousand words longer than A Game of Authors. That spring, Universal Pictures offered $4,000 for the screen rights to The Dragon in the Sea. They presented an unfavorable contract, which gave them every conceivable right of recorded and filmed reproduction, a contract his film agent, Ned Brown, did not like at all. He wanted to hold out for a better offer. But Dad went for the bird in the hand and said he would accept without further delay or negotiation. Reluctantly, Ned proceeded to have the contract drawn up. While quite a bit of money for 1957, it disappeared quickly, going for old bills that had been accumulating. Dad remained confused about his writing and was having trouble finding his literary voice. He contacted other writers for advice to see what he might be doing wrong. Several gave him the cold shoulder. He was just another young writer to them, pestering them, taking them away from their writing. For a time, he had received advice from Lurton's brother Wyatt, a successful short story writer, but their last contact had been a year before. One professional in Portland did offer quite a bit of advice, Tommy Thompson. A well-known screenwriter and short story writer, Thompson told Dad never to talk about a story he planned to write or that he was in the process of writing. "Just go ahead and write it," he said. "Don't waste your energy trying to explain it." Thompson, who lived in Santa Rosa and Portland at various times, built a steam engine into an old Studebaker and ran the car on steam. It ran well, and set my father to thinking about alternative energy sources, a concept he would champion 2 decades later. Referring to himself as a Jeffersonian, Frank Herbert was an admirer of the nation's second president, John Adams. These men, Jefferson, Adams, and Herbert, were suspicious of the holders of power. Dad added a twist of his own, asserting that charismatic leaders were extremely dangerous. "It's one thing to make mistakes for yourself," he said, "but if you're a charismatic leader and you blunder, millions of people can follow you over the cliff." In The Dragon in the Sea, the crew of the Fenian Ram followed Captain Sparrow slavishly, a perilous situation in my father's opinion. This was a precursor to the dangerous power structure that formed around Paul Atreides, as Dad later described in the Dune series. Dad missed the Puget Sound area of Washington State where he had been born. It was his Terra, and he had done his best writing there, including most of Dragon. It was a wild thought, perhaps, but in 1957 he felt in his gut that another move might provide the inspiration he needed. Ever cooperative, my mother contacted retail advertising people she knew in the Seattle-Tacoma area. As luck would have it, an advertising copywriter position turned up at a large department store in Tacoma, the Bon Marche, at a slightly higher salary. She was hired, and management accepted her request for a summer employment date after Bruce and I had completed our current school semesters. Penny remained with her mother in Florence, Oregon, on the Pacific coast. Just before our departure for Washington State, a friend from the Hitchcock campaign told Dad about a U.S. Department of Agriculture research station that was, coincidentally, near Florence. It was in an area of unstable sand dunes that were being driven by wind over buildings and roads, inundating them. By planting poverty grasses, the USDA had discovered a successful method of stabilizing dunes, preventing them from traveling. It was a pilot project, and due to its success, government officials were coming from all over the world to see it. Israel, Pakistan, Algeria, and Chile were among the interested nations. Dad was intrigued. He knew from his studies of history that the Sahara and other desert regions had not always been desolate. Once they had been green and fertile, sustaining great and powerful civilizations. Many of these civilizations were subsequently buried by slow-moving, relentless sand encroachment, causing more destruction than any human invader could. Dad thought he might write a magazine article on the project. He chartered a Cessna 150 single-engine plane with pilot and flew to Florence. There he compiled notes and took photos. It was as advertised. The Department of Agriculture had stopped the sand. On the way back, Dad gazed down on sand dunes that were like waves on a great sea, and he felt an emotional pull. He returned to Portland and focused his attentions upon yet another move. In the summer of 1957, we rented a house in Browns Point, Washington, just north of Tacoma. One bedroom was on the main floor, on the street side, and Dad converted it to a study. He had always wanted an antique roll-top desk, and shortly after the move, he purchased a large one from a private owner who had advertised it. The desk was dark oak, with little drawers and cubbyholes, and writing boards that pulled out on the right and left sides. In his new study, Dad placed a row of reference books along the top shelf of the desk. His Olympia portable typewriter went on a typing table by the desk. A singing cowboy rug that Mom had crocheted from a drawing of mine was laid on the floor, and his Mexican serape with silver clips went over a side chair. On the walls he hung a calendar and old maritime maps, with inaccurate but quaint cartographic impressions of the continents. He organized his musical tapes and set up his reel-to-reel tape deck and speakers so that it could fill the entire house with music. With all his preparations, we were in the house for nearly a week before he wrote a word. Now he set to work on the magazine article, which he entitled, "They Stopped the Moving Sands." The rapid staccato hum of his typewriter became constant background noise, a machine drone that I almost filtered out. His schedule at the time was to begin writing at midnight and work until at least 8 a.m. In this way, he had quiet, uninterrupted time. The typewriter was my father's mistress, permitted by my mother. In this unpublished haiku poem, he described what it was like at that time of night. Typewriter clacking in my night-encircled room. Metal insect song. I've never seen anyone type as fast as Dad. I hesitate to call it touch typing, since his fingers moved so quickly over the keys that they didn't seem to touch them at all. When I interviewed Howie Hansen, my father's closest friend, he said to me, "Frank was some kind of a typist. I never saw anybody that could sit there while you're talking, as I'm talking right now, and whose fingers would be flying, and who at the end of your conversation would rip the page right out of the typewriter and hand you your finished conversation. Frank would do that. I always accused him of showing off, and he would say, 'What? Who, me? Huh, you know me better than that. And then we'd both laugh roaringly. Sometimes, remaining ever so quiet, I watched my father at work in his study, through the open door or from outside in the yard. When he wasn't typing, he edited pages with a pen or pencil, scribbling rapidly. He talked to himself in there, reading dialogue aloud. Not being a writer myself at the time, I had no understanding of the benefit of this technique, which makes dialogue more realistic, more flowing. Having heard that crazy people talked to themselves, I put the proverbial two and two together and decided he must be out of his mind. He was so different from other kids' fathers anyway, with his beard and bohemian lifestyle. He didn't hold down regular jobs, didn't play catch with me in the backyard or go to baseball games with me the way normal fathers did. He didn't even allow us to have a television. Each morning, Dad drove Mom to work at the Bone Marsh department store in downtown Tacoma and then picked her up in the afternoon. Our car was a gray 1950 Studebaker that looked like some kind of a weird rolling airplane cockpit. This delivery service took him an hour and a half to 2 hours a day in all, and was necessary since my mother refused to drive, especially in city traffic. She was dependent upon him for many things, almost like a baby, so helpless without him. But he was just as dependent upon her in other ways. She edited his manuscripts and typed the final drafts. She listened attentively and made suggestions as he read each story to her aloud. She found missing things for him, keeping his delicate emotional state balanced. Dad was, in reality, completely helpless without her. But I would not realize it until many years later. My brother and I shared an insatiable curiosity about the contents of our father's desk. I often saw Bruce in the dangerous inner sanctum of the study, and at every opportunity I was in there as well. I got into Dad's things most in the afternoons, when he was picking Mom up at work. He had the most intriguing objects in his desk, and I spent hours at a time looking at them. He had a black and silver fountain pen, like Jack Vance's. I liked the pen very much. It felt good and substantial in my hand. In cubbyholes were piled stacks of 5x7 notepads with the drawing of a typewriter on top of each sheet, and the words, "From the desk of Frank Herbert." In cubbyholes and drawers and on the desktop were old eyeglasses, little prisms wrapped carefully in tissue paper, fortunes from Chinese fortune cookies, pens, pencils, slide rules in a variety of shapes, political campaign buttons, typewriter ribbons wrapped in plastic bags to keep the ribbons from drying out, little boxes and little bags and things held together with rubber bands. There were boxes of Bond typing paper and stacks of inexpensive newsprint, used by my parents for first drafts and carbon copies. My father always had a cardboard manuscript box on his desk or on the typewriter stand by it. The box, which originally came with Bond typing paper in it, was slid open on one end by Dad and used to hold the completed pages. The slitted end enabled him to handle pages easily while still keeping them organized in a box. His portable typewriter sat on a typing table on the left side of the desk, and I never touched this machine for the wrath it might bring down upon me. Any slip in that realm would spell big trouble, because Dad always said the keys could be sprung if they weren't hit just right, with an even rhythm. He was extremely sensitive to the touch of his keyboard. As letters and other paperwork came into his study, he impaled them on a copy spike on the top shelf of the desk. When in the middle of a story, he only answered the most important, earth-shaking correspondence. Everything else waited, and he developed the habit of piling up huge stacks of unanswered mail. He focused his energies upon the story in his typewriter, to the exclusion of almost everything and everyone else. When the story was finished and in the mail to his agent, he would then spend days in succession answering every letter. His study was, in a very real sense, a sacred place in our home. I had only a faint understanding of the mysterious incantations and rituals he performed in there with his writing implements, but I knew all of his things were to be given supreme respect. So any time I was in there, I took great pains to disrupt nothing, and always listened for noises as nervously as a cat, sounds that might suggest the approach of the Lord of the Domain. I examined small areas at a time, always replacing each item exactly as I had found it. The door of his study had a humorous sign on the outside that I never laughed about when I lived in his household. A fiendish cartoon character was depicted, with the caption, "I don't get ulcers. I give them." From her job at the Bon Marche, Mom often brought home advertising layouts to work on. Many featured fashion drawings of women. On her Olympia portable typewriter, she pecked out advertising copy on newsprint, which she cut out and moved around on large sheets of paper, positioning copy and illustrations. When satisfied, she secured everything in place with rubber cement. She did well at the department store, receiving a promotion to advertising manager and then to sales promotion manager. After a few days of working on, they stopped the moving sands. Dad realized he had something bigger in front of him than a magazine article. He sat back at his desk and remembered flying over the Oregon dunes in a Cessna. Sand. A desert world. He envisioned the Earth without technology to stop encroaching sand dunes and extrapolated that idea until an entire planet had become a desert. What sorts of characters might populate such a world? And what was their history? What religion would they follow? This last was an important question, perhaps one of the key questions he would have to answer. Three of the world's major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, came into existence and grew in desert regions, in sand, in desolation. This was the canvas he needed for the complex story he wanted to write about a hero. He selected the most fanatical of the three faiths, Islam. The story would include an Arab-like worldview, and the hero would be a messiah. He envisioned a desert messiah like the Mahdi or Muhammad on horseback, with a ragtag army on horse and camelback with him, thundering across the desert. This leader would be charismatic, capable of inspiring intense loyalty among his people. A power structure would develop around him. My father wanted a novel that would incorporate real elements from history, mixing them and casting them in a new light, always keeping in mind the saying of one of his favorite literary figures, Ezra Pound, "Make it new." Frank Herbert knew comparatively little about the complex ecosystems of deserts, but set about a thorough course of personal study. He wanted to do something futuristic in his setting, involving desert technology and advanced methods of desert warfare. Despite his mainstream leanings, he found himself changing course again and realized this had to be a science fiction novel. He needed the elbow room afforded by the genre. This story would have a big canvas. Dad scoured every library and bookstore for books about deserts, desert peoples and languages, and desert religions. He learned about the behavior of sand, desert storms, water control, and dry land life forms. And he learned how people survived in the hostile, desolate environments. He read T.E. Lawrence's 1926 masterpiece about war in the desert, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. His Library of Congress research skills served him well in this endeavor, for he was able to skim books and articles for the information he needed, avoiding long, time-consuming passages. But sometimes his innate boyish curiosity got in the way and slowed him down. While looking for one thing, he would become interested in another, and would spend hours learning about a topic that had little or nothing to do with the story he wanted to write. His notes began filling file folders. The unfinished magazine article went into one of those folders. Background information about the ecology of the desert planet. The story would not occur on Earth, but the characters would be human. Readers would identify best with humans, he believed. And borrowing from the American Indian's opinion of white culture, he would describe how man inflicts himself upon his environment, usurping it, and failing to live in harmony with it. He had the science fiction bug once more, but for a respite from the rigors of novel research, he began writing short stories in that genre again and mailing them off to Lurton in New York City. This was not a total commitment to science fiction, as from time to time he would continue to make attempts at mainstream stories. Sometimes Dad kidded Mom about having a black spot on her lower back, a mark that came and went. He said it was a Mongolian spot. indicating that she was either part Indian or part Asian. This conflicted with what Mom had been told by her family, who claimed that they had only pure East Coast blood in their veins.
On her mother's side, she was a Landis, descending from Swiss Mennonites. On her father's side, she was a Stuart, said to be a descendant of Scottish royalty.
My parents were totally faithful to one another, and rarely argued about anything, at least not in front of the children. They were remarkably compatible. There were a few exceptions. From the first days of their marriage, Dad depended upon Mom to find things for him. She was the white witch of our family, he said, with mysterious methods even she could not fathom. As a natural consequence, Dad had a tendency toward carelessness about where he left personal articles, his keys, wallet, eyeglasses, books, and the like. Sometimes his habits irritated her because he would interrupt her in the midst of her work or some other activity, demanding that she find something for him. If she didn't leap to his aid, he became quite upset. "I'm married to a large child," she sometimes said, in a tone of bemused resignation. Once, to apologize for behaving poorly, Dad typed her this note. "Forgive me, darling, if I'm rash, if prudence doesn't prevail. For I needs must be a man at times. I needs must be a male." To this, she typed a reply on the same sheet of paper. "You say you needs must be a man. You needs must be a male. Our romance, if you weren't a man, might go a little stale." In some respects, such as Dad's dependence upon Mom to find things, it was a symbiotic relationship, with unlike organisms living together. Another aspect of symbiosis lay in her dependence upon him to drive her everywhere she wanted to go. In 1956, she did obtain an Oregon State driver's license, passing all the tests. Then she didn't use it, and let it lapse. I hesitate to classify their relationship entirely as symbiotic, or entirely anything else, because no aspect of my parents fits neatly into descriptive niches. They were each dependent upon the other. Where one had a shortcoming, such as an inability to find things or to drive, the other filled in, and they became a complete organism. Where one needed time to write, the other worked to support the family. Frank and Beverly Herbert were inseparable. On Thanksgiving Day, 1957, Dad and a photographer friend, Johnny Bickle, went to a wild animal sanctuary near the Green River in Washington State called Hidden Valley Ranch. The place was run by George H. Westbow and his wife, Margaret. Dad wanted to write a story on the Westbows for one of the slick national magazines, and he and Johnny were taking photos. The Westbows had a huge lioness called Little Tyke, who was internationally famous since it was a vegetarian and had never eaten meat. It had been featured in a film documentary and best-selling book, Little Tyke. The grounds of the compound were lovely, with a pond, rich foliage, and exotic birds, including peacocks and swans. At dinner, George Westbow spoke of his famous lioness, who had died a short time before. He told of advertising for a caretaker one time, and a young couple called. Westbow forgot to tell them about the lioness. As the couple came up the walkway, the man carrying a baby, Little Tyke appeared suddenly and bounded toward them. The woman ran away screaming. The man followed close behind, but not before dropping the baby on the ground in the path of the lioness. Little Tyke only licked the child's face, but the couple did not get the job. I visited Hidden Valley Ranch once with my parents and heard another story. One of George Westbow's favorite tricks was to have an uninformed visitor sit on Little Tyke's couch in the sunroom of the house, a room that looked out upon the pond. At first, the animal took the balance of the couch, right next to the visitor. But gradually, she nudged the person more and more, until she had the whole couch, and the visitor was on the floor. Dad's feature about Hidden Valley Ranch didn't sell, but late in 1957 and early in 1958, his science fiction short stories began taking hold again. Three would be published in 1958. Old Rambling House, Galaxy, April. You Take the High Road, Astounding Science Fiction, May, and A Matter of Traces, Fantastic Universe, November. Old Rambling House reflected our itinerant lifestyle and Dad's hatred of the IRS. A young couple, not unlike my mother and father, had grown tired of constantly moving. They decided to purchase a large house. Unfortunately, the house was not what they expected it to be. It transported them to another planet, where they were told that the people who sold them the house were tax collectors. The new owners were expected to fill the vacated positions. Whenever Grandma and Grandpa Herbert came to visit and stay with us, Babe insisted on cleaning our house. She caught up on all the chores my mother didn't get around to with her busy schedule. The beds were made with fresh sheets and clean, sweet-smelling blankets. Babe even ironed the sheets. If Grandma was a neatnik, my father was a beatnik before the term came into vogue. He was a person leading an alternate lifestyle, without steady employment. Whenever Grandma was around, she always exuded a slight air of disapproval about her son's lack of gainful enterprise and the way he didn't live in one place for very long. She and other McCarthys, who classified people in black and white terms, saw him as something of a black sheep who didn't provide adequately for his family. One morning, Dad was surf casting on the beach near our house at Brown's Point. He heard a bang and looked around. A strange man was lurching along the beach, coming toward him. The man had a fedora pulled down over his eyebrows and wore a ragged tweed trench coat with the collar up so that it covered the lower part of his face, revealing only his eyes. He walked with a terrible crazy slouch, in my father's words, and gripped a .38 caliber pistol in his right hand. Bang! A bullet hit the sand at water's edge, well away from Dad. Then another shot rang out, and the man was getting closer. Calmly, Frank Herbert turned away and cast his line into the surf. Bang! Bang! Each shot rang out louder than the one before. When the demented creature was only 3 feet away, Dad said, without turning, "Hi, Howie. How you been?" They exchanged profane insults, and then had a good laugh. Dad hadn't seen Howie in a while, but he explained it this way. "I don't know why, but the first glance was enough. I knew it was Howie. I knew it was Howie." Howie put it this way. "I was trying to give him no place to go but Puget Sound. I wanted him to make a motion for the ocean." The men then yammered and stammered, as Howie described their playful bantering, and went back in the house. A little shorter than my father, Howie often wore a dark blue nautical cap. He had a ruddy square face and intelligent eyes. Of my father's many male friends, none touched his heart like this one. No matter where we moved or how far away Howie was on a maritime assignment, the men always kept in touch. One time after a separation of a few months, Dad sent Howie a telegram that said, "Right, damn it, right, or we're through, by God, through." From a week before the 4th of July to a week afterward, a man who lived next door to us set off firecrackers and rockets until 10 or 11 o'clock each night. Dad and Howie decided to get even. At 2 o'clock one morning, they set off thunderous cherry bombs in his front yard by his bedroom window. Lights went on in the house, and the man ran outside in his underwear. He couldn't see who was creating the disturbance. When Dad and Howie saw him outside, they split up. Dad hid behind bushes in the front yard, while Howie went in the backyard and did the same thing. Then Howie shouted, "I got him! Here he is!" The man ran to the back, whereupon Dad set off cherry bombs in the front yard. Variations on this followed, and they kept the fellow running back and forth in confusion. By this time, I was outside in my pajamas. Seeing Howie sneaking back into our yard, I said, "Hey, that's you and Dad shooting off firecrackers, huh?" Howie laughed. In describing his friend, Howie said Frank had an infectious sense of fun. Unfortunately, my father rarely showed this side to us, his children. If we saw it at all, it was as observers, not as participants. In 1957, Avon paid $1,500 for the paperback rights to The Dragon in the Sea. They would publish it under yet another title, which Dad hated, 21st Century Sub. So, in a short period of time, the same story was serialized as Under Pressure, printed in hardcover as The Dragon in the Sea, and in paperback as 21st Century Sub. When the check for 21st Century Sub arrived, Dad was so pleased that he wanted to take Mom out for a gourmet meal. We didn't own a vehicle that ran, so Howie loaned Dad his big gray 1949 Chrysler Windsor, a nice two-door car with white sidewalls. Dad and Howie washed and polished the car. At the restaurant, the finest in Tacoma, the valet congratulated my father on owning such a fine automobile. Dad just smiled and handed him a generous tip for the time, $5. Howie and Dad spent a lot of time discussing religion, particularly the mysticism of many faiths and peoples. They drew parallels between Zen Buddhism, Hinduism, the Kabbalah of Judaism, the Sufis of Islam, and American Indian beliefs. Howie, half Quileute Indian himself, was at once an intellectual giant and a spiritual man. He spoke for his ancestors and for uncounted future generations, and my father was startled by the message of the people speaking through Howie. The earth is dying. It is being misused by non-Indian civilizations that take and do not give. In 1958, after being in the U.S. Merchant Marine for years, Howie returned to his Indian reservation at La Push, Washington, in order to gather legends and songs from the remaining old folks. He had last been there in 1939, and was shocked now to see the damage to the environment. Previously, the area had been a verdant primeval forest, thousands of years old, with young and middle-aged trees and old grandfather trees shading the younger ones. There had been so many trees on the reservation that, to the young man, they had seemed to form a tunnel, with light coming in at the ends. Now, after indiscriminate logging by big timber companies, the area was much different. Howie was saddened and incensed. When he visited us at Brown's Point, he had with him a book entitled Ecology, which had been loaned to him by an Indian friend. The book spoke of the ecological decimation of the planet Earth, and how he combined this knowledge with what he had seen at La Push. In a conversation with Dad, Howie told me he said angrily, "They're going to turn this whole planet into a wasteland, just like North Africa." "Yeah," Frank Herbert responded, "like a big dune." By the time Dad said this, the elements of his story were coming together. He had in mind a messianic leader in a world covered entirely with sand. Ecology would be a central theme of the story, emphasizing the delicate balances of nature. Dad was a daily witness to conditions in Tacoma, which in the 1950s was known as one of the nation's most polluted cities, largely due to a huge smelter whose stack was visible from all over the city, a stack that belched filth into the sky. "The air was so thick you could chew it," my father liked to quip. The increasing pollution he saw all around him, in the city of his birth, contributed to his resolve that something had to be done to save the earth. This became, perhaps, the most important message of Dune. My father would write two great books, tracing themselves in varying degrees to conversations with his closest friend, Howie Hansen. Dune, 1965, and the poetically written story of Indian Rage, Soulcatcher, 1972, my father's only non-science fiction novel. Chapter 12, A Writer in Search of His Voice. In the fall of 1958, Dad's writing career was not going well. We moved to Long Branch, a small town on a bay just north of Tacoma. This had been one of Dad's ports of call as a child when he rode and sailed around Puget Sound. He resumed searching for a job, and as fate would have it, this was an election year. He stopped by Republican campaign headquarters in Tacoma. William Big Bill Bantz, a Spokane, Washington attorney, was running for the U.S. Senate at the time against the popular Henry Scoop Jackson. Bantz had a publicity director who wasn't working out, so his campaign manager, George Carlson, fired him. That day, Carlson received a call from Republican campaign headquarters saying a man had been in looking for a job, Frank Herbert. Carlson had never heard the name before, but met my father the following day, was impressed with him, and hired him. Dad was the best publicity man Carlson ever saw. Frank Herbert would put together six suggested publicity letters at a time and lay them in front of Carlson for review and approval. Carlson remembered approving perhaps four, rejecting one, and specifying revisions on another. It was difficult to find people for jobs like that. The assignments were short-term and demanding, involving highly intensive work. While Dad worked on the political campaign, his fourth, he dovetailed his schedule with Mom's, doing his publicity work in Tacoma while she was writing ads at the department store. Unfortunately, William Bantz, like every other candidate my father worked for, lost. Scoop Jackson, an unbeatable foe in Washington state politics who ultimately went on to national prominence, garnered almost 70% of the vote. Whenever my parents had friends over to the house, I sometimes tried to participate in adult conversations. Typically, it was after dinner, with everyone sitting in the living room by a cozy fireplace. Too often, my inadequate contributions irritated Dad, and he would send me out of the room. My status in the household, Howie told me later, was not dissimilar to that of a dog or a human subspecies. If I didn't please the master, I was dispatched from sight. After seeing my father do this to me more than once, Howie finally told him it was a big mistake, that he should let me participate, and Bruce as well. If he didn't, Howie cautioned, the boys would never bond with their father. Dad listened attentively to his friend, but said he would raise the boys as he saw fit. We would grow up on our own, if need be, as he had. It would be good for us. He refused to change. And how ironic it was that this man, who one day would communicate effectively with millions of people through his writing, could not communicate with his own children. One day I was beachcombing with Howie, and he said to me, "Your father cares about you more than you realize. If necessary, he would give up his life for you." I was astounded to hear this, and didn't know what to believe. My parents played cards frequently, the two-hand version of hearts they had invented on their honeymoon. It was their private game. My mother, being what my father called a white witch, enjoyed a certain advantage over him in these sessions. When Mom was seated, Dad often went to her and leaned down to whisper in her ear, "I love you." She would smile and whisper the same back to him. There were many small acts between my parents that told us how deeply they felt for one another. The way they looked into each other's eyes and squeezed hands, their secret smiles, whispered words, and lingering kisses. The help they gave one another. Often when she came into the room, he would exclaim, "Hi, beautiful," and she would reply, "Oh, you're just saying that because you mean it." They exchanged little gifts for no special occasion. He gave her red roses or her favorite perfume, Chanel No. 5, and she made him shirts and sweaters. To a large extent, we lived off the land. Dad maintained a pen of chickens, providing eggs and meat. We had a large, neat vegetable garden across the gravel driveway from the garage, and it provided us with the sweetest carrots I've ever tasted. Mom worked with an artist named Nancy Modall, whose parents owned a waterfront cabin near us. I knew a spot in the woods near their place where huckleberries grew in abundance. So in the summer and fall, I rode my bike over there and harvested them for Mom's incredible pies. I also brought in blackberries by the bushelful from a field by our house. To clean the berries, Mom dumped them in buckets of water. Most of the bugs, tiny worms, and debris floated to the top, enabling her to remove them with a spoon or strainer. In distributing her prize desserts to us, Dad employed a variation on Solomon's wisdom, thus preventing Bruce and me from arguing over who was going to get the largest piece. He ordered one of us to cut, and the other to select first. At Thanksgiving that year, as always, Dad prepared what he called Stuffing Herbert, a concoction with chestnuts, celery, and wild rice. Grandma and Grandpa Herbert joined us, and we gathered around our little table in the kitchen. My mother always kept abreast of what Dad was writing, and she watched for newspaper or magazine articles or books that might be of interest to him. Frequently, she guided him into areas he hadn't considered. Both of them read voraciously on every conceivable subject, and she constantly threw ideas at him that he subsequently incorporated into his stories. Early in 1959, Mom was offered an important job as advertising manager for a new department store in Stockton, California, Smith & Lang. It was time for another move. Dad said we had to fit all of our things in a U-Haul trailer and on the top rack of our car. Much had to be sold or put in storage with friends. Thinking our Studebaker wouldn't survive the trip, he sold it for only $50. It was leaking water and oil from the engine, and he thought it might have a blown head gasket. He told the buyer everything he knew that was wrong with the vehicle and cautioned him, "Just run it until it stops. Whatever you do, don't take the engine apart." But the purchaser of the car, despite my father's honesty, didn't listen and proceeded instead to take the engine apart piece by piece. Just before we left, he phoned to shout at Dad and call him names. Dad reminded him of what he had told him, and the man, unable to counter my father's debating skills, slammed the receiver down. Almost a decade later, in his novel The Santa Roga Barrier, 1968, Dad wrote of a utopian town in which anyone advertising to sell a used car had to reveal all defects in advertisements. An ad for a $100 Buick described it as an oil burner, while a $500 Rover had a cracked block. The town, Santa Roga, refused all pork barrel government projects. The people were straightforward, honest, and didn't ask for special favors. They didn't smoke or watch television. In one of the most memorable passages of Dune, 1965, the Princess Irulan said her father once told her that respect for the truth comes close to being the basis of all morality. This was Frank Herbert speaking through his characters. By the end of February, we were on the road south in a big black 1951 Nash, a car with a six-cylinder engine that only ran on four. The ugliest thing I had ever seen. It looked like a giant bloated potato bug. A big U-Haul trailer with a tarp flapping in the wind rolled along behind us, and there were suitcases on the top rack of the car. We had, as my father liked to say, packed with a shoehorn. In this process, known well to us, items were packed within items. Everything possible was nested, even if it meant mixing items from different parts of the house. This made for interesting adventures trying to locate things later, but was the most compact possible method of transport. We didn't have a wasted centimeter, or bring along a single unnecessary item. So much for Tara, for the Washington State homeland where Dad could write. While he sold two short stories that were published early in 1959, Missing Link, Astounding Science Fiction, February, and Operation Haystack, Astounding Science Fiction, May, they took him only a few weeks to write. He wasn't putting out very many words, though he continued to perform research for his desert book. Avenues of research were shooting out in all directions. Maybe with the economic stability of Mom's new job, he reasoned, he would have the time and resources to increase his output. In Stockton, we rented a modern ranch-style home with an option to buy. It was a sturdily built one-story rambler with a painted concrete patio in the backyard and a big weedy field beyond that. Mom planted a small vegetable garden next to the garage, and I particularly recall how delicious the asparagus was. Shortly after moving in, Dad pursued a wild scheme. He had heard about high-altitude Air Force Weather Service, ptarmigan flights, over remote regions of Alaska, the Bering Sea, and the North Pole. Ever curious, he wanted to go along on one of them in order to obtain material for a magazine article. So he contacted one of his old political buddies for help, Congressman Jack Westland, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Washington State. Westland tried, but the Air Force rejected the request, citing extremely dangerous conditions encountered during the flights, and the unwillingness of authorities to expose civilians to such peril. In more recent times, with different technology, my father would have been trying to get a seat on the space shuttle, probably with similar results. He did not do well when it came to getting his ideas through bureaucratic channels. I don't think he ever figured out how to work through the decision-making processes of governmental and large private bureaucracies. Such endeavors apparently required more patience than he possessed. Within 2 weeks of our arrival in Stockton, Dad was receiving child support demands from Flora's attorney. Since we couldn't make the payments and Dad needed to balance the ledger, Penny came to live with us. The house was big enough for all of us to have our own bedrooms. Dad set his study up in the master bedroom, which was large. Lurton Blassingame kept pressing my father for more material, and the agent made a number of inadvertent comments about the low output of stories, remarks that irritated Dad. Frank Herbert was finding it more and more difficult to send stories to New York for reasons he couldn't quite define. The relationship with Lurton and science fiction publishers was becoming a rut, with increasingly negative connotations. Frank Herbert wanted to write for magazines that paid well, not for science fiction pulps at 4 and 5 cents a word. "I was floundering," he confided to me years later, "not making a living. Bev was patient, but wanted to buy a house, ending our itinerant lifestyle. She didn't complain, but I knew she wanted to settle down. I was nearly 40 years old, with little to show for myself." His book about the desert was almost becoming too massive to envision finishing. To do it right, he wanted to create a universe and several cultures, a formidable, disheartening task that was bogging him down in the tedium of research. Thus far, he had committed very little to paper, only disjointed plot ideas, descriptive passages, and characterizations. His personal library was burgeoning. He had cardboard boxes full of notes. To earn money more quickly, he thought about writing television scripts and purchased several books about the craft. He came up with a television show idea about a manfish, a web-footed merman, and spent time writing a synopsis. MCA in Beverly Hills expressed an interest in the project, and he sent it off to them through his film agent, Ned Brown. It didn't sell.
A later version, written in 1965, also didn't sell. In the second version, there were not only web-footed mermen, but shark goddesses as well.
In ensuing years, Dad would write other television treatments, all without success. Part of his problem, as paradoxical as it sounds, might have been that he rarely watched television. Our Hall Avenue house was the first home in which we had a set, and that one, an old Zenith portable, was given to us by a friend.
The boob tube, or cyclops, as Dad called it at various times, arrived in our household amidst all sorts of dire warnings from him about how it would harm our bodies by emitting X-rays within 6 feet of it, and our minds, through idiot programming and the devious subliminal messages of advertisers. In The Santa Rosa Barrier, 1968, he would make a scathing attack on television, implying that people who watched too much of it had their mental faculties sucked away. In describing the town of Santa Rosa, which differed from normal American society, he wrote, "Dacine grew aware of an absence about the houses he saw. No television flicker, no cathode living rooms, no walls washed in skim milk gray by the omnipresent tube."
Around this time, Dad became acquainted with the Zen writings of Alan W. Watts, particularly The Wisdom of Insecurity, which postulated the abandonment of safe courses of action in favor of uncertainty and insecurity. Watts spoke of a paradox in which the abandonment of safe courses of action opened a person to ineffable spiritual truths that could not otherwise be attained. Frank Herbert held a similar belief, that the natural state of equilibrium in the universe was not a stable fixed point or condition of being. It was instead a changing thing, always presenting new faces and new experiences. For an individual to be in harmony with the universe, my father believed, he needed to place himself in synchronization with the changing state of nature and human society. He needed to take risks. Thus, in many of his stories, he stressed the importance of adaptability, and his characters often had to adjust in order to survive. So it was in our family, with the constant moving from place to place. I was always the new kid on the block, the new kid in school, having to fit into unfamiliar social and educational structures. He told me that without change, without constant challenge, something in the human mind goes to sleep. "That's why I keep moving," he said, "why I keep looking for new experiences." My mother wrote a series of advertisements for Smith & Lang that won national awards and became famous around the country. The first ad went something like this: "We're glad to be opening Smith & Lang again because our roots go deep here in the valley of the San Joaquin." This was a brand new store, replacing one that had burned down. Subsequently, a number of stores on the East Coast picked up the advertising theme and began saying things like, "Our roots go deep in the Valley of Virginia," or "Our roots go deep in the hills of the Catskills." Around New Year's 1960, After less than a year in Stockton, Dad reached the emotional low point of his career. His writing income in 1959 had been only a few $100 from a pair of science fiction short stories and the trickle of earnings on Dragon. With the money he owed to bill collectors, including the Internal Revenue Service, who had levied a federal tax lien against him, his net worth was below zero. He even owed me back allowance. While in Stockton, Dad wrote a mainstream story entitled The Iron Maiden, an amusing yarn with strong sexual content. Approximately 4,500 words long, it was turned down by a number of publishers. Later, Dad would rewrite it under a pseudonym with an anagram surname, Ephraim Thurber, but it would fare no better. Editors liked it, but for a variety of reasons, including length and a flat ending, it did not quite fit their needs. Around this time, Dad also wrote a 12,000-word mainstream story entitled The Little Window, about a Greek shoemaker and his young nephew, both of whom worked in a shop below street level. The store had a tiny window in the front, providing a view of the shoes and lower legs of passers-by on the sidewalk outside. The shop workers saw everyone in terms of the shoes they wore. And in this story, Frank Herbert made a number of interesting psychological comments about different types of people. The action of the tale concerned a gang of thugs who commandeered the shop with the intention of using it as a base of operations, to rob an armored car on its regular rounds in the neighborhood. Here my father was putting on paper a story about an armored car heist that his father had told him. The protagonist of The Little Window was the shoemaker's young nephew, who bore the interesting name Paul, a name that would reappear one day as the protagonist of Dune. Earlier, he had also used the name in Paul's Friend, the unpublished story of heroics in the South Pacific hurricane. The Little Window was cleverly told, but had length problems. Lurton showed it to a number of magazines, including Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, since they were purchasing crime, detective, and suspense stories. He tried mainstream publications as well, such as Cosmopolitan. But no one wanted the story. I was struck by several scenes near the end of the story. In one, Paul overpowered a young hoodlum and took his rifle, which he then used to shoot the gang leader, who was running across the street. As he aimed at the gang leader, holding the rifle against his shoulder with the elbow out, Paul recalled the words of his army sergeant, "Lead him a little. Lead him!" This was from Dad's experiences as a young hunter, when his father and uncles taught him how to shoot running deer and fowl in flight. After killing the gangster, an act of heroism that protected the lives of innocent people, Paul felt terrible remorse for having taken a life. This was Frank Herbert, speaking from his own heart. During the Depression, when he had to hunt to put food on the table, he felt remorse each time he shot game. It was a philosophy of nonviolence that would ultimately lead to his involvement in the movement to stop the war in Vietnam. His anti-war beliefs were directly linked to his ecological writings, including the yet-to-be-written works Dune, 1965, The Green Brain, 1966, and New World or No World, 1970. Wars were devastating not only to people, but in the harm they inflicted upon the environment. The old shoemaker in The Little Window, upon passing by his shop from the outside, looked through the window and saw for the first time how small and dirty the place was. He lamented having spent 31 years there with very little to show for it. Just a squalid little shop with a little window. This was a remarkable and poignant metaphor for the life of Frank Herbert up to that point. He was 39 at the time he wrote the story. 31 years after declaring on his 8th birthday that he wanted to be a author. The shoemaker's craft was a metaphor for the writing craft, and the shop window, like the window my father had on the world, which he realized was very limited indeed. The more he researched and studied, the more he realized how much he did not know, and it frustrated him. He was a man in terrible fear that life was passing him by. At his best, my father was a stream-of-consciousness writer, putting words on paper that emanated from emotions deep within his being, words that came almost automatically. I don't think he was fully aware of the metaphorical, semi-autobiographical aspects of The Little Window. This man made efforts to psychoanalyze other people, but very often failed to perceive his own motivations. Dad had another short story in search of a publisher around this time. Entitled A Thorn in the Bush, it bore surface similarities with A Game of Authors. Like Authors, it was set in a small Mexican village and involved a mysterious foreigner hiding from the past. This time, it was an aging and infamous whorehouse madam from Alaska. The protagonist in Thorn was a young painter who fell in love with a beautiful but crippled Mexican girl, under the watchful, protective eye of the ex-madam. The story was seen by a number of publishers, most of whom considered it well-written. Unfortunately, the length, at 18,000 words, was again cited as a problem. It didn't fit into available spaces. With the failure to find publishers, my father was coming to believe that Lurton had lost faith in his ability to produce good, marketable manuscripts. Concerning the Little Window manuscript, Lurton saw immediately that it was a length that would be difficult to sell, but he wrote that he would try to market it nonetheless. The use of this word, try, sent my father through the roof. He said anyone using that word was presupposing failure, and in a letter he blasted Lurton. I had heard variations of this diatribe myself, in which Dad picked apart every word I used. Lurton didn't take it lying down, and told my father he had no one to blame but himself for not adequately analyzing magazine and book markets. Dad apologized. In his heart of hearts, he knew the problem was of his own making and could not be blamed on anyone else. He was a man in an artistic wilderness, struggling to find his voice, struggling to find himself. He couldn't decide about subject matter, length or genre. He waffled between short stories, too long short stories, too short novelettes and novels, and between mainstream, crime stories, adventures, mysteries, and science fiction. Intermittently, he came up with ideas for television programs. Most of his ideas went nowhere. Frank Herbert wasn't focused, with one exception. In stops and starts, he continued the monumental research for his big novel, the pie-in-the-sky book that might never be pulled together. He refused to copy other styles or formulas, even though they had proven successful to other writers. He wanted to write something entirely different, of uncommon intellectual complexity, in a new form. In the spring of 1960, Mom used her contacts in the retail advertising field to find an even better job in a glittering jewel of a city almost due west, San Francisco. Bruce and I would have to leave school in the middle of the semester, but we were old troopers, having done this before. Penny married a truck driver named Ron Merritt, and they settled in Stockton to raise a family. The move to the city by the bay would prove to be very important for my father. It would place him in an oasis of intellectualism and culture, offering far more rewards for his investigative mind than Stockton. Chapter 13. Zen and the Working Class. The San Francisco Bay Area would ensnare my father with its charms for almost the entire decade of the 1960s. But as we navigated the highway west out of Stockton, I didn't know that, and was considering the benefits of keeping most of my things packed in cardboard boxes in my new room. That way I wouldn't have to continually pack and unpack. How many houses had I lived in now? I had lost count. Our potato bug-shaped Nash pulled yet another U-Haul trailer. We didn't have everything we owned with us, since a lot of our stuff had been left in storage with Howie in Seattle a couple of years before, and other items had been stored with Ralph and Irene Slattery even longer. On San Francisco's Potrero Hill, a working-class neighborhood of weathered Victorian row houses, we rented a flat, an entire level on the third floor of one of the houses. Within months, we moved into a house that became available next door. Dad quipped that we moved because we didn't like the neighborhood. It was a one-story white stucco house, built around 1930, with hardwood maple floors throughout and a red tile roof. It was not a large house, so Dad put up his roll-top desk in the dining room. The old portable typewriters were getting long in the tooth, as he put it when something was past its prime, so he purchased a big Olympia electric typewriter, which was faster than the manual and made a smoother sound as he typed on it. We had a black wicker couch in the living room, with a round, red-lacquered Chinese coffee table that featured a black dragon design in the center. The table had carved legs that curved outward. When Dad read his manuscripts to Mom in this room, he sat on the couch, leaning over pages spread across the Chinese table, while she knitted or crocheted. Every few moments, she took a long drag on a cigarette, causing the tip to flare red hot. When deep in conversation, she often didn't put the cigarette down and kept working at it, tapping ashes meticulously into her ashtray. Within a short time, my parents made many intellectual friends in the Bay Area. Artists, poets, psychologists, newspapermen, science fiction writers. They came for small dinner parties and retired afterward to the living room, where they talked and drank wine with Mom and Dad far into the night. Above all, my parents resumed their relationship with Jack and Norma Vance, who now lived just across the bay in the Oakland Hills. Through the Vances, Dad met the well-known science fiction writer Paul Anderson and his wife Karen, who lived nearby. The three couples became fast friends and shared many fine dinners and outings together. The Chinese coffee table in our living room was a reflection of my father's increasing interest in Eastern culture and thought. In his study and scattered all over the house were books reflecting the wide-ranging diversity of his mind, including philosophy, history, politics, mythology, mathematics, religion, foreign languages, deserts, ecology, mythology, science, and technology. In San Francisco, Mom learned how to make charts and predictions from the book of I Ching, Chinese astrology. Using this and her other means of prediction, she said to me one day, "Brian, you will marry a blonde," which turned out to be correct. And after she showed me how the I Ching worked, I had trouble putting the book down. She also predicted that she would die one day in a distant land, which also turned out to be right. Afterward, she was in the living room with knitting on her lap, lamenting to Dad about this, since she wanted to see so much of the world. It almost seemed amusing to her, but he perceived her fear because of accurate predictions she had made in the past. During her entire life, my mother tap-danced with the paranormal. It frightened her, but few other subjects intrigued her as much. So every once in a while, like an addict, she ventured into the dangerous realm of prediction. Dad kissed her and told her not to worry. "After all, darling," he said, "your predictions don't always come true." She returned to her knitting, but pensively. For my mother, predictions were always considered carefully, never disregarded. "I don't know where I'll die," Dad said in a cheerful tone, "but I know what I'll be doing. I'll be at a keyboard, pounding out a story." Around this time, my father was teaching himself kanji, the linguistic characters of China and Japan. He mixed his own black ink in a stone inkwell and, with a fat brush, made characters on large sheets of rice paper, true to the artistic technique of those cultures. The paper was thin and shrank and wrinkled around the lettering. Shortly after arriving in San Francisco, Dad got rid of the Nash. He negotiated a flat monthly taxi rate to transport Mom to and from the White House department store, where she wrote fashion advertisements. Thereafter, at a set time every weekday morning, a green and red Veterans Cab Company car showed up outside. It was a 25-minute ride each way to her job at the White House department store. Now, at long last, Dad was free of having to drive her. I played trumpet in the Everett Junior High School band. Mom liked my horn playing, but Dad had me under orders to practice only when he wasn't writing. Still, he must have held some affection for my music, though he never told me so, since he wrote a humorous haiku poem about it. A 17-syllable Japanese form of poetry, it went like this. "Number one son play, his horn better every day. Still, neighbors move away." One day at school, I got into a confrontation with a future Hall of Fame football player. the notorious O.J. Simpson. At the age of 13, I was in the habit of carrying cheap ballpoint pens in my shirt pocket. Sort of a 1960s nerd look, but without a plastic pocket liner or slide rule. I was in the courtyard of the school, and a wiry black kid of around my height pulled the pens out of my pocket and threw them on the ground. I outweighed him, and to me he didn't look very tough. He had two friends with him. "Pick him up," I said. "Make me," the kid said, glaring. I shoved him, and he shoved back. "Get him, O.J.," one of his companions said. "Get that white boy." The ensuing fight, which had no clear victor, was soon broken up by a gym teacher. O.J. and I never had another confrontation and eventually became friendly. We often ran into one another on the 22 Fillmore bus, where we had a number of pleasant conversations. In the summer of 1960, Dad accepted a position once more in the newspaper industry. He became night picture editor with the San Francisco Examiner, working the 4 p.m. to midnight shift. The steady old reliable news profession, a fallback position, offered relative security. With Frank Herbert's tremendous qualifications and abilities in this field, jobs were almost always available to him for the asking, though he often went to great lengths to avoid asking. The Examiner, which Dad and other employees referred to as the X, was owned by the Hearst Corporation and was the flagship of the chain, the very first newspaper owned and operated by William Randolph Hearst, Sr. The Examiner building was old, solid, and colorful, and still a bustle of activity. In newspaper circles, it was considered hallowed ground. Each weekday, Dad wrote or researched in the mornings and early afternoons. At shortly after 3 p.m., he would walk down to 3rd Street near Bethlehem Steel, where he caught a city bus. It took him downtown to the Examiner building at 3rd and Market. By riding in the mornings, I gave my best energies to myself, Dad recalled. The X got what was left. After he had been on the job a while, he went to the paper's book review editor and made an interesting proposition. In exchange for free books, Dad offered to write book review outlines in his spare time, which could then be fleshed out by the editor. I'm a fast reader, Frank Herbert said, and when I'm at the typewriter, it goes like a machine gun. The offer was accepted, and Dad received his pick from carloads of books received by the book review staff. He outlined a wide range of fiction and nonfiction, but the books he wanted to keep were almost entirely nonfiction. Works of history, especially Arab history, religion, psychology, ESP, dry land ecology, geology, linguistics, anthropology, botany, navigation. William Randolph Hearst, Sr., a legendary figure, had worked in the Examiner building himself in years past. Traditionally, old newspaper files were kept in what was called the morgue. It wasn't called that on any Hearst paper, however, since the old man had an abhorrence for anything involving death. On his papers, it was called the library. After working there 6 months, Dad was in the Examiner library one evening and saw several big photo album-sized volumes stacked on a table. Ever curious, he opened one of the books and was astounded to find original communications from Hearst, who had died in 1951. Frank Herbert took a deep breath and looked around. He didn't know where these albums were normally kept, but realized they should not have been left out. He was alone in a library. If Hearst sent a note, a telegram, or a cablegram, they were kept in the albums. These were his orders, filed chronologically. Some were, in my father's words, absolutely astounding. One telegram sent from the Hearst castle at San Simeon said something like, "Who wrote the headline top of column 3, page 8, first edition Sunday? Fire that man." Some telegrams from San Simeon told the city editor to assign a photographer and a reporter. The photographer was needed because he had a car. They were to assemble something like 51 halves of roast chicken, 28 orders of coleslaw, and 16 cakes, and put them on the 3 p.m. train to San Simeon. Hearst was having a party. Dad closed the albums and chuckled softly to himself. A well-known Sausalito artist named Vargas was a sailing buddy of my father's. Vargas also knew Zen master Alan Watts, as they were neighbors in Sausalito, just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. When Dad expressed an interest in interviewing Watts for an Examiner story, Vargas arranged a meeting. This was no ordinary story for my father. He wanted to learn more about the most elusive of all religious philosophies he had encountered, Zen Buddhism. He had read every word Watts had ever written, and had made extensive notes from these and other Zen writings for his desert novel, a novel that still had not reached much beyond the file-building stage. Now Frank Herbert wanted to synthesize the information he had been reading, to hear what a master had to say personally.
Watts lived on the old ferry boat Vallejo, which had been retired and was moored in the picturesque town of that name.
A passageway in which one had to bend over led from Watts's quarters to the quarters of another occupant of the ferry, Vargas. My father and Alan Watts were charmed by one another's company and became friends. Watts used to invite Dad over for dinner and conversation, serving him Oriental food on black and white china in a black and white room. It was very Zen, my father recalled, but our conversations were Catholic in the universal sense. Watts was particularly taken by one of Dad's observations, that a person's personality could be compared with the impurities of a diamond. A diamond's value is determined by its impurities, Dad told him.
2 decades later, Frank Herbert would write in Chapter House Dune, "Some precious stones could be identified by their impurities. Experts mapped impurities within the stones. A secret fingerprint. People were like that. You often knew them by their defects. The glittering surface told you too little. Good identification required you to look deep inside and see the impurities. There was the gem quality of a total being. What would Van Gogh have been without impurities?"
This was the height of Frank Herbert's Oriental period. Aside from the meetings with Watts, the extensive research, the Oriental furniture in our house, the writings of kanji characters, and fortune-telling from the I Ching, Dad called me number one son, and Bruce number two son. We ate Chinese or Japanese food several times a week. Bruce and I received gifts of Chinese thinking caps and sets of origami paper. Dad hung a calendar from Chinatown on the wall of his study, and he gave Mom a beautiful red and black kimono, which she wore on special occasions. My father was happy at the Examiner, and with the respectable combined income he and Mom were bringing in, we were able to live a little better. We owed money to a lot of people, including Dad's Aunt Peg, Mom's Aunt Ruth, Jack Vance, Dad's former wife Flora, businesses in the various towns in which we had lived, and last, but certainly not least, the IRS. Mom established